Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Frank Gehry has changed the course of architecture. His creations, such as the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain, and the Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles, created a new architectural language. Pulitzer Prize winner Paul Goldberger, former architecture critic for The New York Times and The New Yorker, has written a new biography of Gehry, perhaps the most famous architect of our time. Building Art, the Life and Work of Frank Gehry, presents and evaluates the work of a man who helped transform contemporary architecture with his innovative use of materials, design, and form. And it's a pleasure to welcome Paul Goldberger to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Joe. Nice to be here.
You are certainly known as a critic. At what point did you think, I would like to be a biographer?
It was more about wanting to just push myself in a new direction while still making use of what I know, which is architecture. I've been writing architecture criticism a long time. I love it, but any writer, I think, wants to exercise some different muscles. And I could say that taking on this book prevented me from falling into the trap a lot of journalists do when they want to do something different, which was to write a novel. So I decided to sort of find a way to do something different that would nevertheless avoid trying to write fiction.
So here is a guy, Frank Gehry, who is someone that you have written about for a number of years, who you know, you have known for 40 years. So to pick him as the subject and to say, I want to look at his life, especially when you've written so much criticism of the work, how were you able to differentiate the two?
Well, you know, as a critic, you've always got to have some degree of distance.
Right.
And so I had to be as disciplined as I could in this case in making sure that distance remained. The most important thing to say about this, though, is that Frank Gehry and I had a conversation before I took on the project in which I said, I would love to do this, but I can only do it if you cooperate fully and at the same time agree that you have no control over the text. It has to be an independent book. And if you can't bring yourself to do that, I understand. Plenty of people would feel that way, but then I will find another project. I will not do it. He said, no, I'm okay with doing it. And he has kept his word. I know that there are some things in this book he doesn't like. He has not asked me to change them. He didn't see it until it was very close to going to press. That's how it is. And
do you think that was hard for him, especially in the story that you write? Here is a guy who will often look at a project, say, I don't like what I see, and walk away.
Yes, he's done that many, many times. I think on a funny level, everything is hard for him. He's a guy who has a huge amount of angst in his life. He's achieved phenomenal things. He's been, as you say, the most successful architect of our time. And yet, he always feels as if he hasn't done well enough or missed something or whatever. I know he basically likes this book, but there are a lot of things in it he wishes weren't there, but he knows it's not for him to control, and he's been very decent about that. It's a funny thing, writing a biography of a living subject. But you have to keep in mind at every moment you're doing it, you're not writing it for that subject, you're writing it about him. Very different things.
The quote you have in the book of Gehry on success is, success is always harder to deal with than failure.
He really believes that. And it's not that he's being Pollyanna-ish about how failure teaches you things, although it does and he knows it. He has a very ambivalent feeling about success. It shows you the two sides of his character. In the one sense, he's driven and ambitious, but there's also a quality of him that's a little bit afraid of success, that thinks maybe he did something wrong, that it just creates a level of expectation that will be impossible to achieve. So he knows that, in fact, success has its own completely different set of challenges than failure.
You write in the book, you were talking about angst earlier, even though Gary was ridden with angst throughout his life, his manner came off as relaxed, low-key, and amiable. And his steely determination, far from being obvious, like Frank Lloyd writes, was hidden behind an easygoing exterior, a kind of aw-shucks air that Gary's old friend, the artist Peter Alexander, called his gentle, humble ways. Wright was never mistaken for being modest. Gary often was.
Yes.
Is he a modest man?
No, he's not a modest man. But he's a man who has a very modest demeanor. Those are, I think, two different things. He is very, very competitive. He's very ambitious. But he really is sweet-natured and kind in a lot of ways. And so I tried to show those two different and admittedly contradictory sides of his character.
Why do you think so many, certainly early on, but even to this day, don't quite get it? Don't quite get him, don't quite get the work.
It's true that a lot of people, even people who like his work, like it for the wrong reasons. He is misunderstood as somebody who just puts crazy shapes all over the place and arbitrarily makes these unusual shapes and then forces them upon people, and that they don't function well and they cost too much. In fact, almost every part of that is untrue. One of the things I hope the book will do is correct some of those misconceptions about him. He is as concerned about function as anybody. He changes his buildings continually in response to clients as the design is being developed. I've never seen somebody whose buildings went through so many different versions until the final one was achieved. He just has his own vocabulary, his own way of making things that is a little bit different from most other people's. But it is not sculpture. It really is architecture. He really does care where the toilets go. He really does care that the thing stand up. He really does care if the owner of a house says, I need 4 bedrooms for my 4 children, and I want a guest wing over here, and I want this there. He does it that way. He doesn't say, no, there's a perfect shape I've conceived of, and you have to fit into it. He is the opposite of that. And he actually is cost conscious, much more so than he's given credit for. So I hope the book will explain some of these things.
You quote Hal Foster in the book,
yes,
the Princeton art historian, mm-hmm, who says that Gary was trying too hard to intrude into the realm of sculpture and produce buildings that provided spectacle more than architectural rigor. When you look at the buildings, there certainly is that, mm-hmm, that spectacle.
Yes, absolutely.
But for you as the architecture critic, what makes them so architecturally special?
Let me say first that his buildings are not a model for what all architecture should be. A lot of the argument that it's too much spectacle is based on the premise that, if everything looked like that, we'd have nothing but chaos. Well, of course we'd have nothing but chaos. Everything is not supposed to look like that. A paragraph should not have too many punctuation marks in it, and too many exclamation points, actually. Gary designs the exclamation points in the city. That's what he's best at doing. Other people might be the nouns and the verbs, mm-hmm, or something. He is very interested in architecture that affects us emotionally. He is much less interested in intellectual theory. And I think that part of the criticism of, say, Hal Foster is based on an academic view that architecture must adhere to a certain kind of rigorous academic theory. Gary's architecture, in fact, is not particularly intellectual. It is much more intuitive. It's much more about feeling and about showing us how extraordinary and unusual shapes can actually achieve some of the same feelings that we get from much more traditional buildings. You know, in a lot of ways, he's a traditional architect. He is not interested. The thing he likes least, I think, are minimalist modern boxes. You know, he actually wants to decorate. He just does it in his own way. And it is, as I said, kind of intuitive and instinctive. And academics who believe everything must be based on a theory often have a problem with that.
Paul Goldberger is our guest. His new book is Building Art, The Life and Work of Frank Gehry, and it is published by Knopf. You mentioned the exclamation point in the city. That city is often, and certainly was at the beginning, Los Angeles. He came from Toronto to Los Angeles.
Right.
And has quite a relationship with that city. And for a long time, there alone until Bilbao and then and then other corners of the world.
Absolutely. And he has a very complicated relationship, I think, with Los Angeles. He arrived there at 18, worked as a truck driver initially, went to architecture school, went to college at night, and gradually became more interested in architecture, but didn't think at the outset that's what he'd be doing. But he has always had a feel for the kind of gritty ordinariness of the Los Angeles landscape. And he has said many times that he thought, for example, that suburban tract houses that were going up all over that region in the 50s as he was coming of age in Los Angeles were much more beautiful when they were frames than when they were finished. And so he began to take that idea of wood framing and wonder what he could do with it and actually make real architecture out of it and other inexpensive materials, most famously chain link fencing. He has found an unexpected beauty in and used as a sculptural and architectural material. Over the years, his relationship to Los Angeles has become much more complex. It's been much more than just taking these ordinary things from the part of the Los Angeles landscape that most people disdained and wondering if you could make something beautiful out of it. He's also become very much part of the Los Angeles power structure now that he's so successful. And that creates its own very different set of challenges. And when Walt Disney Concert Hall, which is possibly his greatest public building, which took 16 years, when it was running into trouble in the about 5 or 6 years after he won a competition to design the building, it was costing too much at that point. They were having trouble building it. They were having trouble raising money, a lot of issues politically. The project halted altogether, and he was so embittered he considered leaving Los Angeles and came very close to doing that. Eventually, the project restarted. It was a huge success. It actually was finished on budget and is now considered, you know, one of the great triumphs. But there was a time when he would have probably designed someone's kitchen if it was far enough away from Los Angeles, because he loved excuses to leave home because he was so unhappy there for a while.
I've interviewed him a few times, and it seems that it certainly is what made him famous, but also the thing he seems proudest about is Bilbao.
Yes, I think he is, because Bilbao is a building that really changed the whole culture. It broke the boundaries of architecture and got people who don't think that much about architecture to go see it and begin to think about it. I think it's the most successful building at doing that than anything since Frank Lloyd Wright's building for that other Guggenheim Museum, the related institution in New York, which was almost 50 years earlier, 40 years earlier. It was 1959. So his feelings about Bilbao run very, very deep. It's what thrust him into the international spotlight. It made him a household word and not just someone well known to other architects. It changed Bilbao completely. You know, a year and a half ago, he went back there for his 85th birthday. He decided he wanted to mark his 85th birthday back in that building and brought his family. And the museum and the people of Bilbao ended up turning it into a huge dinner in his honor. And there were 400 people there, which was not what he intended when he went. But I think they recognize that it's been transformative for that city and transformative for architecture. Sometimes, not always, by the way, in a good way, because that feeling of too much spectacle and too much focus on spectacular buildings by famous architects has not always been a positive thing. After Bilbao came this mistaken view that all you need is to get a fancy building anywhere and you can turn a city around. Right. In fact, that's not true. It's much, much more complicated than that. Bilbao was an unusual coincidence of a lot of things that just happened to come together in the right way at the right time. You can't make that happen everywhere.
One of the most fascinating parts of the book to me was in speaking about his relationship with Los Angeles, we then look at his relationship with New York.
Yes, yes.
And that is a fascinating relationship. And after, I guess it was Walt Disney, he was started to look into doing the New York Times building.
Yes, right.
So there's a quote you write in the book that once this came on, there was a lot of concern about the design and so forth. And he felt that few people in the architecture community seemed willing to defend him. He was a hero when he designed a building like Bilbao or Walt Disney Concert Hall, but when he was under attack, most of the critics and fellow architects who were so lavish with praise somehow seemed otherwise occupied.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, now that I think was in relationship to the Eisenhower Memorial in Washington.
Correct.
Right, not New York, not one of the New York projects. That's a controversy that's still going on.
Yes.
And that project has not been built. Congress has not yet funded it, even though it's gotten approval from the various planning agencies there. And there are a lot of people who think it's terrible, others who think it's okay. George Will, the columnist, has written a column violently denouncing it. But others very much support it. I think it's good. I don't think it's his greatest work by any means. But it's true that he is a little bit resentful of the fact that his colleagues, who he has often supported and who have supported him on a lot of the high-profile projects, have not come to his defense. The architecture community has not rallied around that. And I think there's a little bit of professional jealousy. People know that Bilbao and Walt Disney are two of the greatest buildings of our time, and almost everybody speaks positively of them. The Eisenhower Memorial is an attempt to do something different. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't work. But I think people are also, there are some people around who are not unhappy to see Frank Gehry take a little heat for a change too.
David Eisenhower walks away from the project after originally supporting it. Other family members are quite vocal in their concern. So that obviously has quite an impact on the overall production of the project.
Well, there are two different camps that have kind of come together on Eisenhower. One is the family that doesn't like it. That's true. Even though David Eisenhower was part of the original commission that voted for it, when his sisters decided they didn't like it, he resigned from the commission and has refused to speak publicly about it since. And then there are all the classicists. There's a whole kind of group of people who are great advocates of traditional architecture who don't like it because it's not a traditional memorial. It doesn't have columns and things like that.
A traditional memorial or a traditional Washington memorial?
I think that's a very good point. A traditional Washington memorial is a better way to put it. They believe that everything in Washington should be classical. I don't. I love great traditional architecture when it's done well, and I have enormous respect for it. But I don't buy the ideology that goes along with it, which is that everything has to be that way. And I think in Washington, Maya Lin's great Vietnam Veterans Memorial shows us the potential of a different design vocabulary to create a very moving and communicative place.
So in looking at his relationship with New York, why was it so difficult to move into
He New did York? Have a very hard time in New York. You're absolutely right. There were several projects that didn't quite get off the ground in New York. Some of it was just, you know, New York is difficult. I mean, we all know that. We live here and struggle with it all the time. Those of us even who love it more than any other city in the world nevertheless acknowledge it's not the world's easiest place to make things happen. And that was some of it. He also had some bad luck with a couple of projects early on. And then there was, as you said a moment ago, the New York Times building project, where the Times invited three very prominent architects to, actually four, I'm sorry, four very prominent architects to prepare a design, and they would choose one. They were very close to selecting Gehry, and he walked away the last minute, fearful that they would be too much an ordinary corporation, and he didn't like to work for that kind of client. He wanted a client with more imagination, and he got the feeling, whether rightly or wrongly, that they were going to be too rigid a client, and that in the end, that they wanted a more conventional office building than they thought they did or than he had designed. And so it was done by Renzo Piano instead. Eventually, he succeeded in a couple of different big projects in New York, the headquarters for IAC, Barry Diller's company, down on 18th Street and the West Side Highway, and 8 Spruce Street, which is a very, very tall apartment building just south of the Brooklyn Bridge. But he also had the Atlantic Yards project and the arena that is now Barclays Arena, were originally his project, and then he lost them. So that was another piece of bad luck in New York.
You spoke a moment ago about the difficulties in writing a biography of someone who's still living. And I would think the most difficult part of that is to look at legacy.
Yes, very hard because, well, I would put that in the larger category of how do you end a biography of somebody? How right. do you end a story that's still going on? And it is tough. I was lucky in that one amazing thing happened last fall, which was the opening of his Fondation Louis Vuitton, the Louis Vuitton Museum outside of Paris, which was a very spectacular event with a huge, huge party, and the president of France opened it and a lot of other stuff going on. And so I went to Paris and followed him around over those few days. And that became the major part of the conclusion of the book, to which I added a few pages of kind of critical reflections on what he means and what his architecture means. But of course, his story does still go on. In fact, he joked to me the other day that he's taken on a couple of, at 86, he's taken on a couple of very big new projects. And he said to me, I hope you're ready to start volume two.
When you think of his greatest work and because one of the criticisms, and you write about in the book, one of the criticisms is how these buildings would hold up.
Yes.
How they would react. I think it's fascinating. The one I live closest to is the Fisher Center near Bard's campus.
Yes.
And in talking to him when he was designing that, there was very much a difference to him of what it looked like at that moment when it opened and what it would look like in a few years when the landscape had sort of taken it over, which it has now, and it's gorgeous. And I guess to put it into a form of a question, he seems to take that very seriously of how those buildings will last.
I think he takes time very seriously. I think he actually knows that buildings exist in an arc, and that not only do they change and evolve over the years, partly because of landscape, but we may use them differently.
Right.
Different people may use them with different sensibilities. And all that changes, just the way we interpret a piece of music or a piece of literature differently over time as well.
Paul Goldberger's new book is Building Art, The Life and Work of Frank Gehry. It is published by Knopf. Paul Goldberger, what a great pleasure. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Special thanks to Paul Ruest and Argo Studios. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.